Hello, Mage fans, and welcome to Mage the Podcast, the podcast that works hard towards ascension so you don't have to. I'm your host, Adam Simpson. I'm joined today by Terry Robinson and Victor Kinzer, who has kindly agreed to join us in this episode of Tomes of Magic as we discuss Isle of the Mighty, a book that was put out for Changeling but had a Mage logo on the back. So we are allowed to discuss this on Mage the Podcast. One of the key themes of this book was the idea of crossovers on the British Isles between Mages and Changelings. And so that's why Terry and I both agreed that we were very pleased that Victor Kinzer agreed to join us tonight. Isle of the Mighty was put out in 1997, and it is 190 pages. It was written by Beth Fishey, Jennifer Hartshorn, Dina McKinney, Wayne Peacock. It was developed by Ian Lemke, the Changeling developer at that time. This is towards the end of first edition Changeling. As a matter of fact, there is an advertisement in the back for the core book for Changeling the Dreaming second edition. So that was just on the horizon there. This book had a lot of great material. And before we get into our regions and start talking about the areas in British Isles, I wanted to give a little bit of a disclaimer here. We have a disclaimer on pronunciations. The third section of the book is on Wales and proper pronunciation of words, places, and names. Required Terry and Adam to take a special crash course. Adam still has the marks on his wrist from the instructor's yardstick, and Terry still has the cheat sheet he smuggled into class in his sleeve. Your hosts today will do their best. If there are any complaints on pronunciations, podcast funds will be used to send Terry and Adam on a trip to Wales to learn pronunciation in the proper setting. If there are no complaints, podcast funds will be used for future episodes.
It was, boy howdy, was some of them rough, where it's just these vast expanses of consonants. The only one I knew ahead of time was CWM, because that is a nuts scrabble word, and I use it whenever I can. So like, quam! I got to see it in its natural environment. And I was very excited about that. And you thought my pronunciation for the Hermetic episode was bad?
I have to be honest. I'm not going to be able to pronounce anything in the Welsh section. It's just, it's not going to happen. And that's okay.
Yeah. There's a great section on verbena in Wales. And when it comes to that, I'm probably going to pronounce it much like a dump truck barreling through an alley and knocking over everything in its wake. But I am going to do my best.
That language was invented on a dare to keep the Romans out. They just saw them approaching and they're like, right, use all their letters, just make them mean something different. People are like, oh, you're abusing the Welsh language. No, they're abusing the Roman alphabet. Okay, buddy, takes two to dance here.
As I was reading a bunch of mage books in first and second edition before I came to this book, there are a number of sections where the mages discuss others outside of their tradition or faction. And a lot of times when changelings are mentioned, the mages are saying to each other, well, I'm not sure changelings exist, or I've heard they exist. I believe they do. But usually it's like they don't even know if changelings are real or not. And then we come to this book, and in every section, mages and changelings are working together on projects on a daily basis. And so I thought, well, that's a real hard change. How does a person, you know, make sense of that? But then Terry and I were discussing it with Victor, and Victor had an excellent point. Victor, please share that with us.
Yeah, so one of the core dynamics of Changeling is the concept of the mists. And in one respect, it's kind of like delirium or fog, where when you see something that's impossible, that's fairy and completely outside of your gestalt, as it were, your brain comes in and says, oh no, that didn't really happen, and you justify it away, and you come up with, you know, a convincing explanation so you can sleep at night. The thing is, that's delirium and fog. Delirium being the werewolf version and fog being the wraith version. They have the same chart of what's your willpower and so how does it affect you. The mists are actually a little bit different. It's an active mystical force. When the shattering happened and the Fae could no longer survive on the Autumn World, then they went through the changeling way, they became changelings, they merged with humans to protect themselves from banality, but the dreaming also helped, and it created the mists, and the mists protect changelings, it keeps them hidden. So if you are a normal mortal and you see something impossible, you see someone using an art to fly through the air, and there's no way that's possible, or float around on a bed, Wayfair does weird things, then you don't just self-justify it away. The story is literally rewritten in your mind. You will remember a completely different series of events. Unlike delirium and fog, where other supernaturals are immune to the effect, no one is immune from the mists. Even changelings aren't immune from the mists. If you take enough chimerical damage and you die chimerically and you become mortal for a while, when you reawaken to yourself, you don't remember everything before that death perfectly. And so if you're writing a mage book and you're writing about what normal mortal mages are just talking about, and they've heard these stories about changelings, maybe some of them regularly collaborate with changelings, but when they're in their chantry talking with all of their other mage friends and they're not enchanted, they haven't had the mist parted, allowing them to see fairy reality, they aren't going to remember any of that, because mages by and large are very banal by changeling standards. And they're banal not because they don't believe in things, but because they only believe in one singular thing. They believe in their paradigm. And mages, by their nature, are not open to differing points of view. That's kind of at the core of the game. And changelings are all about what's possible, and everything's different, and you don't know what's happening moment to moment. So that singularness manifests in the system as banality. And in the system, that means they're very prone to the mists. The mists wipe out that memory from anyone who might be a danger to the Fae. So in this book, because it's intentionally a crossover book, it even opens in an in-universe voice from, I believe, an Islanid she? Fiona she. High Lady Elenid, which is why I remembered Islanid, her name is similar, of the Seelie Court, House Fiona. And she kind of opens with this presentation about, oh, we have all these mages and changelings together and we're going to learn about our history. All of the mages in that setting would be enchanted. They would have had the mist temporarily parted by being imbued with glamour by a changeling. So in that place, in that moment, they know about changelings. And if that glamour fades and then they become a normal mortal again, those memories would go away. And if they're then enchanted again later, they would mostly come back. Again, the more banal they are, the less those memories come back each time they're enchanted. All of that's pretty par for the course if you play changeling all the time. And since this is primarily a changeling text with mage crossover, I think they just wrote from the point of view that the people picking this book up were probably going to be changeling players who also played mage and kind of would know all of that. But you get the people who are mage players who are interested in changeling. And if they haven't, you know, played the game a lot or spent a lot of time reading the other books, those dynamics aren't necessarily going to be self-evident. So I do think it was a little bit of a miss. I may be self-justifying this as well. I may be covering for what is actually a writing miss, but that's how it reads to me.
Yeah, as a mage fan, seeing the mage logo on the bottom of the back cover, I thought, oh, well, this would be fun to find some things to add into my Mage Chronicle, perhaps. And so I'm reading through this, and yeah, there was no explanation of, hey, let's talk about the mists. It's different than the delirium. And so that went right over my head, but thankfully Victor helped me to understand that. So yeah, thanks a lot for taking a few minutes and laying that out for us.
After having my heart broken by Axis Mundi, I was prepared for yet more heartbreak in this book. So it's one of those things where you're like, you got chocolate, my peanut butter, you got peanut butter, my chocolate. You expect this like synergistic blend when in actuality it's chocolate ice cream and it has a small amount of magey peanut butter sauce on the top. But that's fine. We're mages. We have like 86 other books. It's okay. I'm not bitter. Damn you, Mercado. Sorry.
I have to agree. I had much the same thought when reading through Axis Mundi. But as for Isle of the Mighty, it primarily divides itself up into the three regions of the main largest island of the British Isles. And on that island, we have all of Wales, all of Scotland, all of England. We have these sections divided up to England and then Scotland and then Wales. But we're also treated to the old world Fae names for these places. So England is called Albion, Scotland is called Caledonia, and Wales is called Cymru. So when it comes to England, I wanted to open up to our guest Victor and ask what were your thoughts when you were reading through this initial section on England or Albion?
My initial thoughts were there's a lot of really cool stuff in here. The one thing that I really liked is how much human history there was. And this is true of really all the sections. But in England specifically, I really liked the way they broke up the history. It was all rooted in real world human events that they folded the Fae and mages into. And I felt like they did that pretty seamlessly. And not a lot of changeling books do that. Most of the write up on like the early era, the high mythic age is just the Fae walked the world as gods and it was a great time. Yay. And it kind of stops there. Like it's a flowery two paragraphs that more or less boil down to that. And I really liked that they tied all of these real world human events to the history. And especially I felt like with the section on England, you got stuff more specifically about Victoria. And it ends up talking about the Age of Mages. I felt like a lot of the canon stuff was concentrated in this chapter, the stuff that are kind of major hallmarks of the line. And so in that respect, there's a lot more I found memorable in this section than in Scotland and Wales. Not that those didn't have some good stuff in them, but like especially the whole section on Victoria stood out to me. I would say my only real critique, and again, this is more of the format overall, is they pushed the timeline way, way, way back into the deep BC. And while I do like having a few tent poles for that, a little bit more than, you know, the mythic era was great, we walked as gods, it felt like a lot of word count that I don't know that I'm ever going to be able to fold into a game. Everything from the Dark Ages onward, though, I loved having that level of detail and connection to humanity.
And it didn't quite have that like deep mythic history where you have this like primordial information and this could be stories that a mage storyteller could be like, oh, my people tell of this legend and you as a mage are just an embodiment of these first people to come for. It actually has this boring middle part involving the Iron Age. And you're just like, ugh.
Well, and there are reasons for that. The Iron Age is a big deal to fairies for obvious reasons. They have hangups about iron, but... you know, that's the whole metaphor for what caused the sundering. Humans picking up iron caused the sundering. But there's a lot of word count that more or less boils down to like those three sentences. So it's a big book for a source book. It was $22 when it was released. And especially when I was reading this first chapter, again, things that repeated in my feeling from the later chapter, I thought this book could have been shorter and I wouldn't have lost anything. And it still would have been worthwhile. But aside from that, kind of the first hunk of the history section was a little weird and unusable. I really liked the later stuff. It spoke to me.
How about a favorite place in the England region of this book?
I have to say Glastonbury was really my favorite. It stood out to me. Like a lot of the other sections, London, etc., you kind of know it. But they did some really interesting things in Glastonbury, and they brought in a relationship between mages and changelings and a reason that that relationship exists, but it felt lived in a World of Darkness sense in a way that the other sections in the book didn't jump out at me. And then the concept, kind of the idea from this region that I liked the most was also connected to Glastonbury, and that's the Glastonbury Compact. This is a write-up basically where the changelings and the mages of Glastonbury in the Dark Ages, it was pretty much the high Middle Ages, the Tremere came into town because they had heard about all of these powerful myths about the area connected to blood sorcery, so they wanted to possess it. And the mages and the changelings went, well, the mages and the fairies went, nope, absolutely not. We're working together. We're putting aside all of our issues and we're dealing with this. And again, it just lends to it feeling lived in. The thing I liked the most about it, because a lot of it's kind of a high Middle Ages story, it's cool backstory, I could use that in remembrance, but they talk about the fact that they made this agreement and it's still honored. It's never spelled out. This is another one of those things kind of like with the mists, where there's an implication there. If you speak changeling, there's an oath there. There would have to be an oath there. And oaths come with very specific restrictions. And the old oaths that were made during those high magical times last through lifetimes. And so I looked at that and I went, oh, this could be an actual practical story that I would use at my table. Either mages who are bound to this oath they don't know or understand, and breaking it even with spheres would be vulgar, or changelings who maybe know about the oath because of misty remembrance, but they don't remember it quite right, but the dreaming doesn't care, they're going to bind them to it anyway, and navigating that, it felt like it was a better hook for why mages and changelings would really care about each other than I saw elsewhere in the book. What did you guys think about that compact and the whole story they told with it?
One of the things it took me a while to come to terms with is the opposition of the role of story in mage versus changeling, where mages look at a mythic thread and go, I can ride this puppy to vulgar magic for free. So, yes, I'm going to promote you thinking that on the third night of each month you can hear a whippoorwill in this moor, and that's the sign of true love, because that'll let me use mine 3 and 4 without invoking vulgarity. And then you have the changelings who are like, no, that's our sacred history, and the mages are like, sure. But at the same time, the changeling sacred history is a moving object. There's literally a line in C20 that if a changeling tries to read a history book, like, the words go all over the place, which to me is a sign they need to get glasses or possibly go to books on tape. I don't know. That just sounds like dyslexia. But still, as someone who does audiobooks, changeling bros, come to me. I'll trade you wonders for these things. Audible, it's amazing. So just like the completely opposing view of the importance of mythic history, and then this weird thing in the center where changelings are like, we don't remember this. The mages are like, we don't remember this. But suddenly you've got this like buddy cop drama that involves having to kill vampires. Like, that is the best of all possible circumstances. Like, sure, you could have the thing like, oh, we have the sacred oath. We get to kill vampires with changelings. So, like, I have a very surface level reading of it and the very deep reading on the nature of myth. And that's kind of the sandwich of incompetence that I bring to the table.
I would say that story sounds fantastic. And considering that this was a changeling first edition book, and changelings were much more delicate in first edition than they are in the era of C20, that would be an intense story.
So you brought up the term enchantment before, and that sounds like something that is mechanical. Is there a history of changelings and vampires that mage people should know about that, like, for plot purposes, they could accidentally get in the thick of? Because whenever I hear vampires, I think of tanks, and whenever I think of changelings, I think of low willpower glass cannons. And I don't know if that's actually the case, but that's, like, the impression I have in my head.
No, that's exactly the situation. Changelings are the glassiest of cannons. They can very briefly become godlike, and they're good for like 2 rounds, maybe 3 if they roll really well. And then if you survived, they're all out of gumption, so the tides are about to turn. That's kind of how changeling plays, which is great, fun story. It's terrible white room. If you're a white room role player, you're like, well, I want something that's going to match up to my spheres. Man, walk away. It's not going to happen. But they are very much glass cannons. I don't know that there is anything big in the canon in terms of history between changelings and vampires. Really, their relationship with each other can be kind of boiled down to 2 things. One, vampires get very banal as they age. C20 pulled back from the vampires are just banal thing a little bit and made it that every single character has their own banality. You aren't just banal because you're a vampire. But at the end of the day, by the time you're 300 years old, you're pretty set in your ways. You have a way of looking at things. And you might not bring disbelief to the table of banality, but you bring a lot of other things that are banal, that are going to be toxic to changelings, just by virtue of being so old. A 300-year-old mage would have the same problem. And so there's that. There's the other fact that changeling blood is a hallucinogen, and vampires get super addicted to it. The books that True Blood is based on, the author admitted she pulled all her inspiration from the world of darkness, and that is something that came directly out of, I think it was the feeding systems for the original Vampire of the Dark Ages had a chart for the Fae, and it was basically just a chart of addiction and misery. It's a drug. It's hallucinations. You're horribly depressed, but you need more. Like, it goes nowhere good, and yet your character will be constantly driven to find the next hit. So between those 2 things, changelings do not have high opinions of vampires.
Yeah, I don't know changeling, you know, inside and out so well, but I was a big fan of Vampire Second Edition some time back. And when I was reading through this book, I was thinking that vampires would probably be perceived by changelings as a very serious threat. They are powerful. They are perceptive. They're more able than most people to pick up on changelings being something different, something interesting. And I just imagine that something that is undead and unchanging for years, even if it's not 300 years old yet, I'm assuming the banality is going to be higher in that. So I just imagine that when changelings are threatened by more than one vampire, they're going to look for allies or look for escape, or they're going to say, hey, this is not a joke. This is a very serious situation we've got here. You asked for our thoughts on the Glastonbury Compact, and it shouldn't be so surprising that I also picked up on that as one of the ideas from the England section that really appealed to me. It was not only very interesting to read about in the history section, it was not only very plausible to me as a World of Darkness fan that when the Tremere vampires wanted to come to the Glastonbury area in hundreds of years back, that the changelings and the mages would look for allies and say, look, whatever it is, differences we have, we're going to cooperate on this one because there's a real problem. But putting even those aside, just to think that the Glastonbury Compact has never really been revoked, it's never been denounced, it's never been thoroughly broken by a group of people in a noticeable way that is remembered years later. So that can be very useful in a mage chronicle. You can have the mage players, making roles to research things, and they find out, the Glastonbury Compact. You can go to a changeling freehold and invoke that and say, I date, according to the Glastonbury Compact that my forebears made with you, that you need to help me on this, or you need to talk to me about this. And so I see changelings and other denizens of the World of Darkness not necessarily wanting to be open and communicative with different groups. And so I just imagine the average mage going to the average freehold, and the average freehold is like, no, we're not letting you in. We don't want to talk to you. We're going to be quiet until you go away. And so the mage can say, hey, Glastonbury Compact, I can talk to you guys. You need to listen to me. And also another interesting idea there in the Glastonbury Compact was the idea that there was an agreement between the mages and the changelings that they would not seize each other's sacred sites. They would not seize each other's land. And so that was like something that gave some real substance to the compact. It was not just we promised to be nice, but it was more than that.
Yeah, I think that would be really, really good. Being able to show up and speak to the compact. One of the things that I don't know if it was introduced in this book, but it's certainly one of the books where they talk about them more, and I hope I get this pronunciation right, is House Diedne, the hermetic house that sort of brokered the first Mage-Fae compact. And it's one of those houses of hermetics that isn't active anymore. They were wiped out, but it's always a great hook. Oh, you find the old writings. And because there have never really been solid crossover rules, sure, the mists affect everyone, but this is a whole house of hermetics that focused exclusively on things fairy. They might have old documents and tomes that are explicitly protected against the mists. Maybe they saw and they knew what was going to become of the dream. Like, there is all sorts of story you can write there to kind of break the normal rules and make something like that really viable.
So some of the mage factions that would be very well poised to open up communications with changelings, according to the source material, is the Verbena have old agreements with a... also, within the hermetic houses, there's House Miranida or Miranide, which has been rolled into House Ex Miscellanea, but it's still around. From the distant past, for fans of both Mage and also... but also fans of Ars Magica, there was House Diadne, is the way I hear some fans pronounce it. That was removed by mages. That's a little bit of history in both Mage and Ars Magica. But when they were around, they had strong connections with the Fae also. And this book, Isle of the Mighty, makes mention in a few spots about how there are rumors that Diadne mages have returned, but no one's really sure.
It also answers the canon question of why did House Tremere pick Diadne to accuse of diabolism to distract while they themselves were trying to suck up a Zemisi elder and be like, hey, you kept us out of the UK when we needed this blood sorcery, so we're getting back at you. And that is the connection I made. I don't know if that's actually the reason why, but it's just like, rando changeling book explaining the Tremere. I was just disappointed that we didn't get a Tremere hermetic she chapter. That way, like, the assholes of the old World of Darkness could just, like, unite with the Shadow Lords or something like that. Like, the group that everyone loved to hate can just get together and fight over things. I don't know.
Oh, man. Everybody hates the leaders. It's just, unless you are one of the leaders. I have found players are either like, Ventru, Shi, and Shadow Lords forever, or screw those guys. There's not a whole lot in between.
I'm not going to trust anyone with Sovereign. I'm just putting that one out there. So for England, the things I really took away from this were like just little bits and bobs about the World of Darkness. Like they mentioned the Channel Tunnel is open, but frequently closed because of terrorism. They don't say who the terrorists are or why. Like of groups in the United Kingdom that could be terrorists, like I don't see the people who are like, we should have never separated from France blowing up the channel or something like Breton separatists or something like that. So that was kind of weird. My favorite place hands down was the Tower of London, because we got a rando Korax mention, and just like all mage books require a random mention of changelings to be canon, apparently Korax just pop up in weird places. They are were-ravens, and apparently there is a were-raven at the Tower of London. In addition to that, there is the head of, what was it, Bran the Blessed is buried beneath the Tower of London, and during World War II, Nazi head thieves tried to break in and steal it. So, normally I'm not a big fan of historical chronicles, but characters having to stop Nazi head thieves and being aided by a Korax at the Tower of London? I don't know about you. I think I could run that. I also think that in the England section, they kind of gave up the ghost. So one of the things I will mention towards the end in terms of criticism is there's a lot of hills that are apparently important for some reason. Britain doesn't have enough space for all the history that happened there. It's like the Vatican, but worse. And there's a line that says, just west of Glastonbury on the banks of a river lies yet another hill. This one called Bride's Mound by the locals. And the line, yet another hill, I thought was one of the authors like crying for help and being like, why do we have to name all these darn hills? And that was near the section on Stonehenge, which is interesting because Stonehenge is specifically listed as one of the nodes that powers Horizon. It is the third most powerful node on the face of the planet. I love asking people what they think the other two are, like what the more powerful ones are. And we could do an entire episode on that someday if we want to. But one of the recurring themes is like mortals ruin everything, which is weird because like I understand the idea that you're like, oh, banality, or like, oh, the consensus. But at the same time, like these are the people that you need to convince so that all these things can still like persist. And I don't think there was enough material, like it just made everyone look like they were constantly in retreat. There were only occasional things where it's like, hey, people are now interested in British history again. We're going to use that to try and reestablish this paradigm. And that was kind of a thing I wish this section had done. One of the weirder things was they also gave you a peek into the relationship between the technocracy and the traditions. And this was my favorite one, where it said, the technocracy are still considered the enemy, but individuals sometimes break the lines to discuss philosophy, rugby, or the latest James Bond film with other minds that are their equals, which felt very Mage First Edition, as a lot of this book did. The Awakened form a class unto themselves in England. In many cases, majors on both sides of the Ascension were view their opponents as the loyal opposition. And that is a completely different imagining of Mage, which may be true for the British Isles or the UK. But the idea that we disagree with you, but we all want the best of things, I thought was an interesting theme that ran through this book and gave a much brighter view of the Ascension War, coupled with the fact that there are seemingly no Nafandi or Marauders here, except for like two. But I was hoping for more on Stonehenge.
It's funny when you mentioned about the kind of framing where the technocracy and the traditions are like loyal opposition. One of the things that stood out to me about this book is how much it talks about the Order of Reason. And I don't remember seeing a lot of Order of Reason texts prior to Sorcerer's Crusade. They were certainly mentioned, they'd been written up, but this came out before Sorcerer's Crusade did by roughly a year. And, you know, before that drop, Shy of the Fragile Path, I think this is the most Order of Reason text that I've seen, because in the history section, they talk about Victoria and her reorganization. And one thing that I thought was really interesting, and I'd never seen this framing before, they talk about how Victoria reorganized everything and made everything shipshape. And then when she died, the old men came in and wiped away her reforms and went in a totally different direction. And I'm like, wait, are we painting Victoria as the good guy? Wait, what just happened? To me, that kind of all lends itself to that theme of maybe there's potential here for more cooperation than people think. And then when you go into Sorcerer's Crusade, there's a whole thing in the Order of Reason book about No, the Order of Reason and the traditions didn't like each other, but they cooperated a lot more than anyone cares to admit, and the technocracy explicitly suppresses that as a propaganda tool. And so it seemed to be, to me, almost the beginning of an idea that ended up being developed quite a bit more later. I might be reading into that, but that's how it seems.
No, I must say I did get the same impression reading about Victoria there and thinking about some of those ideas. So yeah, you weren't the only one to see that. And it is interesting when we get tidbits like that in these books. Well, just to wrap up on England, a place in England that we've been discussing so far, but that I thought was really interesting was what the changelings call the Kingdom of Mists. And that is, if you look at just England itself and you put your finger more towards the center, and then you move west towards the border with Wales. This is where you find the ruins of the Glastonbury Cathedral and the Salisbury Plain, where Stonehenge is located, is in that general area. And so changelings refer to this as the Kingdom of Mists. And in the description of that in this book, I was really very interested in how they talked about a place that is naturally magical. And they didn't really go into detail about the exact structure of that magic. They didn't say, well, it's changeling influence or it's mage influence. They just said this place is naturally very magical. In, roughly 1000 BC AD, somewhere around there, there was a period of time where a wall of effectively mist formed around this area. And at that time, the border between England and Wales was not so well defined. But this area of mist lasted for roughly 1,000, 2,000 or so years. And then when that wall of mist fell down, there were differences there. But something about those mists had edited people's memories about it. And of course, that makes a person think of the mists and changeling, and maybe that was what they were going after. But as a mage fan, I read about this, and it really made me think of how a lot of times when I hear about very interesting mage chronicles that people are running, oftentimes it's not how they use the standard mage factions or how they use the standard spheres or rotes or whatever in mage. What often stands out to me as really being interesting is when they introduce their own material to mage, like their own special class of beings or their own special class of, you know, their own title for a person in mage society, or when they create their own mystic atlas. They pick a few places on the globe and they say these places have, there's very ancient magic here that no one understands, and there's interesting results from that. And Kingdom of Mists is a very good example of that. This is a place where there were a lot of magical things. There was a time when great magical changes took place, and it says still to this day, there are times when mists will form and people will be caught in those mists. They'll be walking nearby and then later they come to and there's a gap in their memory and they don't know quite what happened. And so this is a place that is magical on its own. When it comes to what I thought might have been a shortcoming in the England or Albion section, I gotta say, I might be the only person here, but I thought the technocracy faction that they created for this book was not as appealing. There is a group hidden within the technocracy called the Harbingers of Avalon, and they want to return to traditional notions of British Empire and British great influence over the rest of the globe as they had, say, 200 years before. And so this group is like hiding within the technocracy, and they're really pushing for this old, very parochial view of things, and somehow they're very good at staying out of notice of other technomancers, or technocrats, I should say. This one just didn't appeal to me so much. It wasn't so interesting. It stretched plausibility for me. And when I thought about how might I use this in my campaign, I thought, you know, I might just leave that one on the table. Terry and Victor, did you think anything of the Harbingers of Avalon? Because they mentioned them in all three sections, but...
The one that threw me off is they made mention of Division Zero, and I didn't find any other references to them. Like, the Harbingers of Avalon pop up in a bunch of other books. They're in Core M20 as... and sometimes referred to as Navalon. And in Guide to the Technocracy, they kind of get a remaking where they no longer view necessarily the British Isles as the apex of humanity or anything like that, but the idea of Camelot being what the technocracy should be. And it also pops up in the Mage Storyteller's Guide for Revised. I think it was fine. It's one of those things where it depends on how omnipresent you view the technocracy as being. I got the idea that they kind of viewed the British Isles as, I don't want to say a backwater, but not like the main theater. Like all the action is happening in Europe and the United States, and the British Isles are kind of this in-between place. So to me, I was okay with that because they mentioned like two people, but yeah, they mention it a lot. I feel like that was on like the writer's outline. Everyone's like, oh man, I'm going to hit that button too.
I don't know. I feel like there's a place for that group in a technocracy game, but I don't feel like there's really a place for this book in a technocracy game. Like, what am I going to pull from a changeling book unless I decide to make the main supernatural enemy a bunch of fae, I guess. But even then, most of the things in this book aren't really written for that. They're written for changeling players. So I understand why they went, oh, we want to take, you know, the British Isles group and we want to highlight them here because this book is about the British Isles. But I feel like that sort of lent itself to, well, here's the list of things we need to include because it's part of the UK, instead of what narrative does a mage changeling crossover facilitate? How do we emphasize that? So I think that's probably part of why they come across as a little weak. There are lots of conspiracies in the technocracy, conspiracies within conspiracies within conspiracies. So I don't actually mind the idea that they're able to hide from other technocrats because like every technocracy story is about that, even if it's a little silly, suspend disbelief to make the narrative work. But I don't think that group really makes sense here.
The other interesting thing that Adam brought up is the idea that there are these naturally magical places. And this is a criticism I actually have of a lot of mage players, where we have the sphere system that seemingly makes anything possible, but I always want a game to have this weird other thing, because the spheres are a human contrivance. We've mapped them to the celestial bodies. This is not fundamental to nature necessarily. So when Adam mentions the Kingdom of Mist, it is super interesting for a mage to run into something that does not fit their schema and framework. And I think that is a very powerful lesson in the key themes of mystery and hubris, and creates a world of darkness that is dark, not necessarily in the everyone gets killed by vampires in a back alleyway, but there are things out in the world that are unexplained. And it's also why I love the Zigruggler or the Kalawan or some of the weird shit in the Umbra, where you're like, this doesn't fit into my scheme. So yeah, the Kingdom of Mist was gorgeous in that thing. There's this weird other thing, and it's not just a rote or an effect. It seems to operate by different rules at a different level, and that is something that I wish there were more things in Mage that people could run into. And the places where they do exist, they're generally on the other side of the Umbra. So the fact that this exists in a place that you can buy a plane ticket and then take a bus to, I think was super cool.
Well, at this point, I think we ought to move on and talk about Scotland, or as the changelings call it, Caledonia. Victor, tell us your thoughts on the Scotland section of the book.
I generally liked the Scottish section of the book. As I mentioned earlier, I didn't feel like there was quite as much core meta plot here, but there were some details that I liked. I thought that they folded in little things really nicely in this particular chapter. One particular area that really stood out to me, and it's not huge, it's not big like the Glastonbury area, but it's Aberdeen. And it's a small thing, but Aberdeen opens up with this line about how it now controls a sizable portion of the country's wealth due to oil interests. And when I think oil interests in the world of darkness, I think Pentex, I think corruption, I think terrible. But then it goes in and it makes this section all about House Dougal and knockers. And even in the previous text about those fae, and they're the creative fae, they're the smiths and the tinkerers, they're the ones who honestly I would think would get along better with mages, that like creative impulse, and not just like art creative, but I have to make a thing, it has to exist, it has to work, it has to change the world, is very present in Dougal's story and in the knocker story. And then tying that to oil, it's small, it's not like they spin it out into some big mythic story, but I really liked it. And I noticed in the Scottish section there were a lot of moments like that. Later on, you know, there's a thing on the Highland clearances, and they get into the Industrial Revolution and how that impacted paradigm for like the verbena and then for the fae. And I think that it's really easy to do the Valley of the Mists, the Glastonbury story. But I liked that they didn't just say, oh, this industrial thing happened and it was terrible, but like, how did you adapt to it? And then we're going to sprinkle these things in over here that are an evidence of fairies thriving in that setting? And how would, you know, it makes you think, how would the Wick feel about that, or the verbena in a modern setting? So that really stood out to me. I really liked that they did that, because especially in first edition Changeling, it tended to lean really heavily on anything modern and mechanical in science is bad. Dougal and Knockers existed, but Dougal especially didn't get developed until second edition. So seeing that get invoked in an early book like this, I thought was really interesting. And I think it creates a nice space for crossover with mages that maybe don't get mentioned as much here, like the Society of Aether. It would have been the Sons of Aether here. They don't get a lot of fairy love, but honestly, you know, after reading 15 fairy books that talk about dream speakers, which I have to say, I'm glad they weren't in here. Having like a whole changeling mage crossover that doesn't center on the dream speakers is amazing. I've always wanted that book that's like Society of Aether and Knockers, yo, we're tight. And this doesn't go all the way there, but I feel like it takes the first step. And I really appreciated that.
So Scotland, I found a few interesting things. So I am weird. I do not necessarily like chronicles that revolve around a thing that you have to do with an object at a place. I like plots that involve you have to do a particular thing at a particular time. So anytime I get a list of holidays, I am generally excited. So this book forced me to reverse a previous longstanding statement that I thought I made. So in previous episodes, I specifically said, my name is Terry Robinson on Mates the Podcast, and I love me a timeline. And this book broke me in terms of timelines, because there are 75 of them and they don't necessarily match what's on the page. My favorite is that in 1884, 1885, the telephone is listed as having been introduced to an area, except for the section on Wales. Apparently, Wales doesn't have telephones yet, based on the timeline, or at least as of 1997. But they include a list of holidays that are generally observed in Scotland, and I thought that was super interesting, because it brings up the rituals, what they're for, what they drew back to. The Beltane ritual is practiced in these areas over the summer. It's the first Sunday night in May. The idea is to cast off ills. This is what you do. And that is another reason that mages and changelings could come together, because they're both observing the same practice, but maybe for wildly different reason. Maybe the kith are reinforcing an oath or fulfilling one, where the verbena or other practitioners, or even the hollow ones who just like the idea of being able to lean on this romantic lore, are using it as a wellspring to collect quintessence, and they run into each other. I liked that. I think it would have been great if the British section just had a list of British bank holidays, and that was their version of it. And the Welsh apparently don't have weekends either. So I was a big fan of the holidays that were listed here, and it gave seasons and it gave places. So maybe you have to run around the country to make sure these things are done in a particular time to keep some magic up and running. I like that. This is also the section where we get Michael Scott. It is rare to get stats for a proper Archmage in Mage the Ascension books, and this is a guy who had a paradox backlash that gave him an arcane a 7. And this is also apparently a time paradox, because this is a flash forward to the book Lost Paths, where if you have an arcane above 5, you don't have the ability to turn it off. So this guy, people were like, rumors tell that he's still around, and then it gives you like the character sheet of the guy who's still around and totally doing stuff. And he's like, I like it. People don't bother me as much. And that's the only accent I'm going to attempt in this thing. And also he has, I think, Spirit 6. So he's also an Archmaster, which we don't run into a lot, and is the second Archmaster of Spirit that we will get among the Hermetics, which I think is kind of neat. But anyway, the other note was the group of changelings that I would introduce into my mage games would probably be the Hollows. I'm not sure if that's the name of the group or the name of the whatever, but they're trying to collect these pre-shattering artifacts. And that is another case where I think there could be a lot of crossover between the two. Like, a lot of mages will be like, I don't care about the magical sword. I'm a matter master and a prime master. I can make my own magical sword. But someone goes, oh, before the gauntlet rose, this was an item of power. And that's one of those cases where, like, oh, eyebrow raise, you have my attention. This could be something that a modern mage literally couldn't do. And they go over the 12 artifacts of the British Empire or something like that. And who doesn't want a little bit of national treasure in their game, where they have to do something like steal the Magna Carta or something like that? And I appreciated that.
I want to jump in there, because when you were describing like trying to find you know, pre-shattering artifacts and this group of changelings. It's totally something changelings would do. Constantly obsessive need to find this. But when I read it initially, it didn't strike me about the mage crossover. You know, mages can create these pocket realms. And strictly on canon, they couldn't do that in the Dark Ages, whatever. Like, let's throw that out and say they could. I can just imagine mages having created a pocket spirit realm filled with magic that was so powerful and so well defended, it survived the shattering. And if it was one of these mages and it had these artifacts, you know, changelings could devote their entire lives to this epic quest and then walk into this chantry literally just strewn with these things that maybe, because mages are the way they are, they don't even care about. I've got spheres. I can do whatever I want. And because changeling is about, it's about tragedy, and man, you'd have to have the right players for this. If it was truly a pre-shattering artifact, it wouldn't survive leaving the chantry. Like,
oh, I get it now.
It would be so wonderful and so terrible. And then the mists would come in and start cleaning it up. But just like, the thing you give them, you make them think they're getting all of these like things, like it's D&D. And then when they come out, you're like, you get two free dots of remembrance. You get to remember what these things are. No one else does. Enjoy that. But it's actually like a tactile thing on your sheet that helps you remember other old memories. Like, that's the most changeling story, and mage makes it possible.
This is why changeling is the darkest game.
Perhaps. But that is a really cool angle. I like... you know, as a mage fan who doesn't know as much about changeling, I really enjoy hearing about those opportunities for why changelings and mages would want to interact. And that really is a great one, Victor. Well, when it comes to Scotland, a place that really appealed to me was the chantry in Edinburgh that Michael Scott founded back in the 1200s, according to the text. And it is the oldest extant, the oldest still existing hermetic chantry, certainly in Scotland and perhaps even the British Isles. They call it the Auld Covenant in the old town part of Edinburgh. And I thought this place, even without Michael Scott, was very interesting. It is a chantry in the city that has five mages and however many apprentices they're currently working with. The location has its own arcane and rather potent arcane. And of course, that's probably in some way connected with Michael Scott. But still, even taking that mage out of the picture, I still think this is very appealing because we are so accustomed to thinking of arcane as being something that is attached to mages and perhaps some mummies and a few others. But to just this idea of putting it on a place appealed to me. And also, we have read in the past about how hermetics, especially in older times, focused a lot of their magic on spirit, not just on forces. And this is a chantry that for a long time has been amassing the results of research on shallowings. And in mage terms, shallowing is when the wall between the regular world and the umbra gets a hole in it or a gap. And this sometimes happens around nodes or around certain nodes. And this is a time when some strange being out of the umbra can just walk into the regular world, or when some unsuspecting sleeper, you know, mortal who doesn't know anything about anything mystical, can just walk right into the umbra and then has to deal with that. And so here's a chantry where they are going to have some old books or research material on shallowings. And so this gives a reason for mages to want to go here. And even setting the books aside, you can say this is a place where you have two or three mages who are continuing this research that Michael Scott started hundreds of years ago. So if you want to know about shallowings, this is your place. And so I see that as being such a neat way to pull in a trip to Scotland in one of my mage chronicles. Well, I think that about wraps up most of our thoughts on Scotland. I'd like to get to Wales, or also called Cymru, and see what we can find in that region before we discuss the book as a whole. And so again, I'm going to open it up to Victor to hear his thoughts on Wales.
I thought the Wales section was interesting. There were a couple really kind of standout spots for me. The one that I liked the most, and it's not a huge plot point, but I sort of gravitated to Cardiff because, you know, Cardiff, Doctor Who, and to me, Doctor Who is tech fairy tale. Like, I always think of Doctor Who and Changeling as being very close bedfellows. And so I saw Cardiff. I'm like, ooh, I wonder what they did with this, because this was... would have been before all of that came about. And a lot of it's like pretty standard, but there was this thing at the end called about the Spectrum. And it's a New World Order venture And of all the mage things to be in the big changeling book, I was expecting if the New World Order showed up, they were going to be the biggest bad guys, just the worst. But that's not what this is. It's a sprawling kiddie techno museum. All the displays are hands-on and interactive, and it goes into like how there's a big IMAX theater, and it preaches the message of science benefits to the children's subconscious. And on one hand, it does kind of read like terrible propaganda perpetuating what will destroy changelings if you read it in that first edition mode. And it's probably how it was intended. But it also kind of invokes the wonder of science and the whole Childer as character concept. It taps some changeling themes. And in modern changeling in C20, science isn't banal. A really hardcore, this is the way it is, nothing else is possible sort of scientific viewpoint would be banal, but plenty of scientists are driven by wonder and possibility and discovering things in the unexplored corners of the universe, and the Fae thrive on that stuff. I mean, that's literally what they feed on. And so seeing what, at least to my modern, you know, C20 player perspective, as being an invocation of that with the New World Order, and like when this book was released, that probably wasn't what was intended. It's, I don't know that it's was designed to be the best idea, but it really stood out to me as something that could turn into a really fascinating story, especially like some incredibly order-driven Dougal Childer who gets wrapped up in this, and you end up with like a changeling New World Order collaboration, the most impossible thing, but like there's the hook. Yeah, I thought it was interesting that like the farther we got into the book, the smaller the hooks got, but almost the more human they got. You start out big meta plot. And by the whales section, I really felt like there were a lot of good little things like that, like a little sidebar on paradigms. Yeah, it struck me as kind of the most intimate chapter.
What was something that grabbed your attention in whales, Terry?
The upside downside to me of whales was, as Victor said, it did feel more intimate. It was less this sprawling list of weird locations that 900 years ago somebody had kicked a swan and now their family is cursed or something like that. And you have to feed a golden acorn to a chipmunk once every month, or otherwise like someone's going to, I don't know, slash your tires. Again, the England section made no sense. The two things I really liked was, as Victor had pointed out, the NWO collaboration, we get a proper Dauntain. We get Lloyd Morgenstern, and the Dauntain are changelings that have been wrapped in banality. They are almost the boring marauders of changeling, or the banality marauders of changeling. In C20, they are changed that for their creatures that for whatever reason have been rejected from the dreaming, and some people are just kind of meh, and other people are like, oh, I'm going to get my dreaming all right. This character is just wants to destroy the Fae. And one of the treasures listed is Lloyd has a powerful army of nasty chimera called the Stone Men. To Fae eyes, these creatures are gray, drab, animated golems, and they serve as the Dauntain spies and occasionally attack any Kithane they encounter. I could see mages very easily getting wrapped up in that, thinking that they are NWO agents. They have never seen, they're these incredibly boring people in the dullest of business suits, and you're like, oh man, those are obviously technocrats. And then they find out they are dealing with something much more possibly insidious, but different than what they expected. And I liked that. The characters in general, I thought, were more interesting than the other chapters. The aside on Welsh cuisine was fascinating, where it's like, we're gonna walk you through rarebit and sausages. And I'm like, that's good. Glad we had space for that. And the thing that felt a little bit on the weak side to me was, I don't know if this is actually true, but the Welsh are kind of cast as like backwoods bumpkin folk. Like they're kind of presented as like, we're in the U.S. Pick the group that we make fun of the most. I'll say the Appalachians. They seem to be like the Appalachians of Britain, where it's like, if you can make your magic look like it's story time, you can totally get away with anything, no matter how vulgar it is. These backward folk don't even have telephones yet. And it's just like, okay. Like, I get that paradigm is important, but it's like, there's an entire nation where you can get away with things as long as it looks like it comes out of a fairy tale. And I'm like, you're really not going to make a differentiation for if it's inside or outside of a technological hub or anything? Like, stuff like that kind of gets me a little bit. You only have to add like a single modifier to it to be like in some areas of Wales, or alternatively, like just to say that it's, yeah, that it is part of culture as opposed to them being like backward in any way. That kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And my family's Irish. We're used to making fun of the Welsh, and even I found that excessive. So
when I was first looking up this book to consider buying it a few years ago, one thing I saw consistently is that basically everyone from any of these regions from the United Kingdom did not like this book. And I was expecting to really not like this book because I'd seen so many terrible reviews of it. I got it as a gift, actually, and I read it and I went, oh, this actually isn't bad. But the critique was all basically, this is a bunch of stereotypes. And I think what you just described sort of plays into that. Something that jumped out at me in all the sections was kind of that rare bit thing. There's another section where there's a whole paragraph on like the jumps you would make to do public transit to get to a place if you were a tourist. Why is this here? It does kind of read like the people that wrote this had some Mage and Changeling stories they wanted to write. And for the UK section, they bought some tourist guides and pulled that over. And
they're listed in the back of the book.
Yeah. And it's like, okay, I get that you use that for reference, but you needed to recognize the things that needed to stay in the tourist guide.
When it comes to the Wales section, two things that stood out to me. One thing that I know I'm nitpicking, but it drove me nuts. The NPCs at the back of the Wales section, when they list the mages, they do not mention the factions to which they belong. And when you read the chapter before that, these mage characters are mentioned and each of them has a faction to which they belong and informs much of what they do. But when I'm going to be referring to this book, you know, months or years later, I'm going to pull it open, look through the NPCs. I'm like, is he a marauder? He's not a marauder. Wait, it would have taken so little space on the island of I believe it's pronounced Anglesey or maybe Anglesey. This is a large island just off the coast of Wales towards the, let's see, that would be the northwest of Wales. And they're called the Ryba Ferclandona. And please don't throw anything at me for that one, but I think that's getting close to the pronunciation. This group not only has a stronghold that they have maintained for hundreds and hundreds of years and must have considerable influence over the entire island of Anglesey, but also they have been practicing their own kind of marriage diplomacy for a very long time. And I thought this was a really neat idea to be able to go back and say, even hundreds of years ago, you shouldn't see the Verbena as this, you know, reclusive group that didn't want to mix with anyone else and thought that they had all the right answers. No, this group, even hundreds of years ago, was looking out and saying, look, it's a dangerous world. There's some things we don't know. It would be good to have some allies. How are we going to make this work? And hundreds of years ago, marriage was a very good way to do diplomacy. Now, of course, that's not the first thing we're going to go to these days, but they were looking to find life mates for their predominantly female Verbena. They were looking not only to other mage factions, they mentioned the Order of Hermes, for example, but also to the Fae. There were a number of she and other prominent changelings who they considered as matches for their Verbena mages. And so over hundreds of years of doing this, they are going to have some very good connections, not only to other mage factions, but to changeling houses, to changeling groups. And I thought this was not only a neat idea for crossovers, but just added a lot of real interesting flavor to the world of darkness in the British Isles.
It plays into Changeling really well because Changeling's whole thing is feudalism is alive and well, we swear. And in a lot of the she houses, there are these old cross marriage stories. And, you know, a lot of players will lean into the, I married my true love from, you know, 1,000 years ago, and we keep reincarnating and finding each other. Well, what if that marriage was arranged? What if you keep finding each other because of an oath and you've reframed this story? And it'd be really interesting to tell a version of that because it's a pretty classic changeling trope with a reincarnated, like, Verbena avatar along with a reincarnated fae and have it bound by a fairy oath, because there are so many of those stories in Changeling. And they decided to use that in what's a Changeling with Mage book, but with the mages, I thought that created some really interesting parallels.
I would have liked to have seen this not have been Verbena. They mention in some cases that it's proto-Verbena and so on, but this would have been, to me, a good opportunity, and Mage doesn't have a lot of them, to really introduce a craft, to create this weird little pocket of mages that aren't associated with the traditions, that do this, that have Fae-inflected magic, that have this very feudal view of things in a way that we don't really get from many of the other mage groups, of having this strong relationship with the land, plus an idea of like a hereditary head of some sort of ceremonial role or something like that. And I think it would have been really cool for them just to be a craft, to be this other weird group that is out there. Again, that's nitpicking. And with a lot of the crossover stuff for all the games, you kind of stick with the core things and you lean on stereotypes a bit more. But if I were to introduce it, I would have this other group. And I think anytime you don't tie a mage to a tradition, you automatically get this air of mystery about them. And that is something as a storyteller I like to do.
That's an interesting idea. It really didn't occur to me, but now that you mention it, that does sound like a really cool thing to be able to add here. Well, at this point, I think we've covered the three regions of the main, of the largest of the British Isles. So at this point, I'd like to just talk about the book in general, the book. And as I was thinking what we could do in this section, there were three general questions going through my mind. And one was, does this book offer good material for mages who are opposing beings from Changeling the Dreaming, whether those are Changelings or Dauntain or something else? Number two, does this book give us good material for mages and Changelings working together? And number three, if you were going to run a mage chronicle in the British Isles, how much of this book would you use?
I'll kind of start. I actually kind of feel like this book doesn't do a great job of introducing changelings as an antagonist for mage. And I think it's largely because it's primarily a changeling book, which I'll list that as a design reason in the way they market it. I don't think it's a good reason. I don't think that was the best way to design the book. Like when I read through this, there's lots of tidbits about mages and it's really kind of fleshed out. Like, you know, that NWO Childhood Techno Museum or the details with the verbena and the marriage contracts. I actually felt like I didn't run into as much of that about changelings. And I think it's because the changeling players already know about changelings. So like the whole section with Dougal and Knockers, that really sung to me because I love the Knockers and I've read the Knocker Kith book and I've read, you know, Book of Houses and, you know, have committed the Dougal chapter to memory because they're my favorite Chi house. But like, if I hadn't done all that, it's a sentence or two. And like the existing experience is just kind of invoked. But if you're primarily a mage player coming to this, yeah, okay, there is some content here. You have some NPCs, they're good stat sheets. But I don't know that this book does a good job to paint the picture about what does all of that really mean. And in that respect, I think it's a much better changeling supplement than it is a mage supplement. Terry, how do you feel about that?
I think there is material on how to have changelings not necessarily as opponents, but kind of as antagonists. I see a lot of cases for annoying changelings to be caught up in a plot that involves a tradition or a technocracy group that is in the British Isles, where you have a character that comes out of nowhere that fits a certain archetype and someone goes, holy shit, Arthur Pendragon is returned and we the changelings need to rally around you. And suddenly things just go sideways. I wouldn't quite call them antagonists, but they can certainly be complicating factors. The one or two Dauntain that are mentioned are possible options, but even in the British section, it specifically says the changelings and mages tend not to oppose each other or something like that. You do have the thing where maybe a changeling is getting annoying to a tradition mage saying, hey, 4,000 years ago, your people made this promise. Obviously, you need to know where this well is, and we're going to bother you or pester you or torture you or steal your stuff until you give it to us. So it gives you a bunch of options, but like, there are no systems. Those are in different books, the Changeling Storyteller Guide and like the Book of Lost Dreams or whatever it is. QV, the interview I did with Charlie Cantrell for more information. But no, I don't think it gave a lot of good opposing information. It kind of gave a few places where they could run into each other, but I wouldn't quite say opposing. The storyteller, I think, would have to bring a bunch to the party. Did you think so, Adam? Or?
Yeah, I would share that opinion. Reading through this book, there's just this assumption that nice changelings and nice mages are going to work together and that can be fun. And yeah, I agree, that can be fun. But I think there's a lot of possibility for a big misunderstanding where good changelings and good mages butt heads. And there's also interesting ideas of, hey, there's this Dauntain mentioned in Wales. I mean, this could be interesting, but it's just assumed that the changeling players are going to look at that and go, oh, I can see how that could be a problem for my changeling chronicle. But mage players are like, what do I do with that? How would my mages piss him off or what? would a fight with him look like? And there's really nothing offered there. For one thing, in our discussion before we started recording, all of us were agreeing that they could have had one line somewhere in this book saying, hey, if you would like crossover rules for spheres and fairy arts, look at this book. I mean, we didn't even get that anywhere in the book. I mean, it really would have helped. Or like some little sidebar. It's like, these two books have this to say, and we've, you know, found this in our own chronicles. Try this, or think of this, or emphasize this theme. It really wasn't there. So that was a bit disappointing.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. I also felt like reading through this book, and I mentioned it a little bit early on, there's a lot that could have been cut. As much as I love a lot of the cool stuff, like I don't need the prehistory to be as detailed as it is. And while there were a lot of NPCs and some of them were kind of cool, they all had like a paragraph or two. I would have preferred a smaller set of NPCs that painted a picture, you know, have half as many NPCs, but then have their backstory be the stuff you're talking about. I don't even think it needs to be the kind of like, you know, stereo instructions manual part of the RPG book that explains it. You could paint a picture with your stories. And I'm a big fan of books that do that. And character backstories are great for that. But they didn't do a lot of that. These are just kind of like, cool, I don't have to come up with names. I can just open this up and pull an NPC. And not to say that's not a useful resource, but I don't need like 120 of that. And this book kind of goes in that direction. So yeah, I feel like a lot of that could have been accomplished without actually losing anything of value. I would have also killed for like 2 pages of rotes that give the real system crunchy people a way to get around the problems with changelings. The myths are a huge problem. The like totally incogent form of like glamour can really throw a wrench in mage. And just like 2 pages of rotes were like, we know this is a hard and fast rule, but like, here's how this one group found their way around it to like smooth this crossover thing a little bit. 2 pages.
One thing that comes to my mind was when we were reading through the Scotland section, there's one or two mentions of a special liquor that is brewed that when people drink it, they can become enchanted and see changelings' true seemings and interact with them better. And so, yeah, I guess that was one detail where they're trying to put something there to help us with crossovers and help us with mixing. But there's no systems for it. It's mentioned once or twice in passing and no more. And a few more elements like that would have been pretty handy, because not every mage character, you know, not every mage player is going to say, oh, yeah, my character reaches for the whiskey and slams one. You know, some people don't roleplay that way.
Yeah, and I mean, with the enchantment, again, I think this is that effect. That's a straight up baseline core changeling book enchantment rule. But even just devoting a few words to saying systematically, this works like enchantment from the core book. And yeah, your average changeling player just reads that and they go, enchantment, that's a system thing. Boom, it's processed, but it's a crossover book. Do the extra lift for the person who has maybe read the changeling core book once but never played it. And so you don't hold on to rules you don't use. I mean, human brains are limited things. It would have been nice to see more of that in here.
Yeah, I know. I, for one, saw the mage logo on the back. It's like, oh, here's something for me. And it's like, okay, there's a lot of things you're assuming I know that I may not.
Yeah, I wouldn't call it a crossover book so much as a book that includes both. Like, it would be like calling the old story collections that World of Darkness put out, where it was like a novel from each line, as crossover. No, it just happens to contain vampire, mage, and werewolf.
Well, were there any other thoughts on the book as a whole?
I did like the way it gave me a taste of like how another game system views the world, where it's like, oh, Changeling is about story and legend and how important it is and how myths do or don't change over time and the difficulties of memory and the idea that something that happened 2,000 years ago could still be fresh in people's mind because of the Changelings or the Fae's weird relationship with time. I thought that was interesting. As a mage player, it was weird getting those long sections of in-character speech where when I started reading in the England section and it was like, oh man, each section has a single paragraph from a character that's mentioned in the text elsewhere. That's cool. And I'm like, I wish Mage had more of that because I kind of like it in moderate amounts. And then you get to the whale section and the entire thing is in character and it's someone yelling about how someone parallel parked incorrectly. And you're like, maybe this is too much. Yep. So if nothing else, it was an interesting peek into how other people do it. Kind of like when Adam and I talked about Axis Mundi and there's this story of why shapeshifting exists. And it is this entirely mythic story. And one of the kids is like, that's not what actually happened. And the elders like, you weren't there. And you're like, oh, okay, I guess that's how werewolves settle things. And that peak was kind of interesting. Did I need 185 pages of that peak? Probably not. It was also weird to see something that was in color. Like, for the last set of books Adam and I have been reading, it has been like a textbook would have been a step up in terms of like paper quality and image quality. And it was weird seeing like a color border and color advertisements in the back. Sometimes that worked well and sometimes it didn't. Like, a lot of the things were kind of in sepia. If I had to boil my criticism of the book down to one page, it would be page 161, which shows a tourist with something happening to them involving sheep. I'm not entirely sure. They are holding a pamphlet of some sort, and there is some rude awakening that is occurring. I don't know if the tables have turned on this person or what, or if they are enchanted sheep or something like that, but I dropped it into the Mage...
Pooka prank.
Exactly. I dropped it into the Mage the Podcast Discord, discord.me/MageThePodcast, and I was like, what is going on here? And one of the immediate replies was, oh, you've discovered the Nafandi of the British Isles. The other comment that occurred in the Discord that I liked was, I was kind of doing a running commentary while I was reading through this. I'm like, oh, this is good. Oh, this is bad. Someone had this amazing quote where they were like, oh man, how are you not excited reading a book where it's 600 years of people searching for things while sad? And I think that was Orange Lazarus who said that. And I'm like, wow, you really hit the nail on the head there. And I... And like,
that's
it was
way too much of Changeling in general.
But hey, I mean, there's a reason I play Mage. It was a neat little peek. One of my questions to you, Victor, is: are all the Changeling books like this?
It really depends on the era of Changeling. This is something I've recently been getting into on Walking Away from Arcadia with Simon. We realize there are three very distinct eras of game development in Changeling, where like the whole approach to the game changed. Early Changeling was very like this. Even some of the later stuff, when they did Book of Houses, it is 100% in-world voice. There's like a tiny introduction where they warn you it's going to be 100% in-world voice. They just tell you up front. The following chapters are training manuals that the houses use for, you know, their new recruits. And when you start each chapter, I think one of them didn't do a good job of representing this, but the rest of them open with, okay, you found this text. Good for you. If you're not a member of the house, we'll find you. And then the whole thing is entirely in voice, an entirely unreliable narrator. It is a whole book of it, shy of like the stat blocks. I mean, basically, if it's not a stat block, it's in-world voice. Changeling really loves that stuff in that era. C20 isn't like that at all. Yeah, but I would say in general, Changeling does a lot more of it than the other lines do.
I guess the other thing is, Victor, if people are interested in more stuff about Changeling, do you think there are other resources they should look to?
So the number one book I recommend is C20. Honestly, I love Changeling. I've always loved Changeling, but the rules are challenging. And C20 did a lot to clean them up and make them more playable. Even just the simple things like using the revised and on damage system makes everything a lot easier to integrate. In terms of explicitly Mage Changeling crossover, I don't think I know of a great rulebook for that. I know that I think it's Dreams and Nightmares, which is the book on the dreaming, goes into what happens when a mage goes into the dreaming and how do their spheres react in this incredibly unstable environment. Spoiler, it's not the way you'd expect. It's not a glorious paradox free for all for the mages. The dreaming does not like being told what to do, and that's how it interprets sphere magic. So there's some interesting ideas there, but in general, I don't know that I can think of a great crossover text for rules. You kind of have to spin some of that stuff up yourself.
I think that just about wraps up our discussion on Isle of the Mighty. Thanks, everyone, for listening today. If you have something to say, please contact us at magethepodcast@gmail.com with your questions, comments, or feedback. Subscribe to Mage the Podcast on iTunes, Google Play, and TuneIn. If you liked the show, others might like it too. And if you leave a review of Mage the Podcast, it makes us more visible in their searches. You can follow us on Twitter @MageThePodcast. We're also on the web at MageThePodcast.com. You can listen to past episodes there and see the complete show notes. I'm even going to dig into my database and find the web links in the back of Isle of the Mighty, and I will include the new links for the ones that I can still find on the web today. This episode is thanks to executive producers Ira Grace, Richard Bat Brewster, John Magnuson, Brendan Morrill, Andrew Katz, Michael Parker, Anders, and Justin. If you would like to become an executive producer for Mage the Podcast, it would help us keep producing episodes. We'd also become a part of our own council to discuss upcoming projects. The link in the show notes will get you started.
And for people interested in following your other work involving Changeling, Victor, where can we find you?
You can find me at walkingawayfromarcadia.podbean.com. That is the podcast I do with Simon Eichhornchen. And we talk about all things Changeling. At this point, there's an impressive backlog. We're in a bit of a lull at the moment, but we're working on another season just because of the frantic cycle we got into on season one. We're actually recording everything. We're gonna have a huge buffer before we start dropping things. But probably in a couple more months, you're going to see a very regular release of episodes there. I also have a couple texts on the Storyteller's Vault, Phoenix Rising, and I did some work with Simon on Kithbook Fawn. And probably by the time this episode goes up, Simon's next book, which I did editing and consulting on, and I'm going to be doing an actual play centered on this book when the next season of Walking Away from Arcadia comes out. Changeling Countless Dreams is probably going to be on the vault by then. We're just doing final layout touches on that. And that is a book with a lot of mage crossover potential. It asks the question, so what happened to all of the dreams of science fiction? What happened to all of the dreams of space exploration and all of those things? And where did those stories go? And so it spends almost 200 pages, not quite, answering that question. And it explicitly pulls a lot of ideas from the Void Engineers. And there are some definite ideas there that are meant to create more technocracy changeling intersection, which is not something most people would think is possible. Yeah, those are all the things I'm involved with right now, if you want to see more of the crazy things I keep myself busy with.
Very nice. Yes, I'm going to look up some of those myself. Those sound great. Well, thanks everyone for listening. Until next time, truth until paradox, baby.
My quote of the book. The woman is a bona fide nymphomaniac reveling in the summer of her life. Go to Wales, get laid. This has been Mage the Podcast. Bye.